Some of you might have noticed that there was a very young meditator in here for a while. Genevieve is a member of our sitting group here on Thursday. She's been coming for a very long time, pretty regularly on Thursdays. And I don't know, maybe about a month ago or 6 weeks ago, she mysteriously stopped coming. And now she's mysteriously showed up again with a baby. And it was really sweet. I was wondering, what is that sound? You know, and I'm the teacher. I'm supposed to be a little bit responsible. And it's maybe someone's having a hard time with their meditation and needs my attention. So I open my eyes and what?
Don't recognize that.
So I opened my eyes and saw that Genevieve had brought her baby. But the attention span of a baby is not long enough for half an hour sitting. So I wanted to invite her in here, but she's nursing now in the library. So in a little while, she'll come and introduce the baby to the group that her mother's been sitting in for all through the pregnancy. But also, that's the idea that this baby is here. And it's also kind of changed my mind a little bit to not be so interested anymore to talk about what I was going to talk about. So I have to kind of start over again, which is nice. It's always good to start over fresh. And one of the things that strikes me a lot about especially meditation practice is the degree to which many of us... I suspect all of us are addicted to our thoughts. And we think that our addictions to alcohol or drugs or whatever is bad, but they ain't nothing compared to our addiction to thinking. And it's quite compulsive, and many people are in denial, don't realize the degree to which they are controlled by their thoughts, or wrapped up in their thoughts, or preoccupied with their thoughts, and our thinking can spin and spin and spin around and around and around. And I know myself, who spent years practicing meditation and practicing mindfulness, that it's easy enough for me to kind of get caught up in the daily concerns of life and going shopping and driving here and there and talking to people, whatever, that I actually lose track for a while sometimes of what's going on in my mind. And when I lose track of what's going on in my mind, I check in after a while. I see that my mind has a certain kind of momentum going, that sometimes it's just kind of beginning to spin faster and faster, or just spinning around. And even if it's not going faster, sometimes the mind is just kind of has a life of its own, thoughts and all that. And one of the great opportunities and gifts, I think, of a meditation practice is to show us, for some people the first time, that there can be a different center of gravity for our life than our thoughts. I think in a sense many of us, without knowing it, take our thinking, our thoughts, and our what's going on in our thinking mind as being kind of the center of gravity of where our life really resides. And, you know, so much of our life energy and preoccupation goes into those thoughts. And, you know, the thoughts can be a whole range of things. Reliving the past. For some people it's not just simply planning the future, but reliving the future. Because the planning has been so often, and fantasies and whatever, and that's kind of often the kind of center of gravity for our lives, and many people take it for granted. That's what else is there? There's no, you know, it's invisible, the fact that we're so caught up in our thoughts. It's kind of like the fish that don't see the ocean that they're in because they're swimming in it. You know, we don't see the fact that we're thinking all the time because we're drowning in them. We're so much caught up in our thoughts. And one of the gifts of meditation is to show us that it's possible to have a different sense of gravity. It isn't that we have to stop thinking or reject our thinking or think that our thinking is bad, but it doesn't have to be the place where we reside. The other place that some people reside, the center of gravity, is not their thoughts, but is their emotions. And the emotions is kind of, they realize the thought's not where it's at, but their emotions is really kind of the center of gravity. And that's where they relate to the world through their emotions. And again, the same thing is true, that one of the gifts of meditation is to show us that our emotional life doesn't have to be the center of gravity for our life energy, for our preoccupation. And it isn't to reject our emotions or feel they're bad or to deny them, but rather it's simply to allow them to exist there, allow our thoughts to exist there, without us placing them in the center of attention, the center of gravity, the center of our being, the central place where our preoccupation is going. And rather, our attention can be, our attention itself, attention can be the center of our gravity. The alertness of mind, the curiosity, the investigatory powers of the mind can become much more the center of gravity. The awareness which resides in our body, the kind of sense of presence in our body, which is not our thoughts and our emotions, can become, as an alternative to our thoughts, can become a center of gravity. And one of the gifts of meditation is to find, to see, kind of quite directly, the difference between being caught up in our thoughts and getting caught up in our emotions, and then almost dropping to a deeper level or lower level of being, lower level of presence, and finding some calm or some ease or some satisfaction in this sense of presence in the fullness of our being that can't be felt when we're only relating to a part of our being. Because our thoughts are only part, our emotions are only a part. But to drop down into the kind of a silent presence that's in the fullness of our being that includes all that is tremendously satisfying and very liberating for people who simply don't know there was an alternative to being, you know, kind of being run around, being chased by all the thoughts or being consumed or directed by their emotions. And I think this is one of the things we find in meditation practice. Not always, it's not always so easy to find it, but one of the opportunities that exists is that we start doing something very simple. We start connecting to the breathing, and the breathing itself is not our emotions and not our thoughts, and it begins showing us there's something else to pay attention to besides the thoughts and the emotions. And it could be a tremendous relief, because what often causes stress with our relationship to our thoughts is not necessarily the thoughts themselves, but the way in which we kind of fuel them or kind of ride them or propel them or are driven by them. The drivenness of them is often what causes stress for us, or kind of anxiety or kind of irritation in the mind. And we realize we don't have to drive them, we don't have to push them along, we don't have to fuel them, we don't have to kind of believe them or be constantly in conflict or doing things with them, but let them alone and drop into this deeper fullness of being. It can be a kind of liberation, a kind of freedom, where a whole different dimension of existing, a whole different dimension of ease, of trust, can be born. And as I say often, I think one of the more religious functions of Buddhist practice, of mindfulness practice, is to discover a level of trust. Buddhists would maybe use the word faith, but I like the word trust a lot. A level of trust that allows us to reside much more in the fullness of our being, regardless of what's happening. There's reasons why we don't like to be in the fullness of our being, because the fullness of our being, to be in touch with what's going on in our body, which is a very important part of our fullness of our being, means we have to be sensitive to how the body registers the joys and sorrows of life. Life is full of joys and sorrows, and they're registered in and through the body. We won't feel that as well, as carefully, if we're spinning around in some fantasy or some thought or thinking about the future or whatever. But to drop down, so people often don't want to be in the fullness of their being, because the fullness of the being sounds, you know, saying it that way, it sounds pretty nice. You know, fullness of being, who doesn't want that, right? But fullness of being includes the whole show, you know, includes the sorrow, the pain, the suffering that is part of life. And it includes the joy and the delight and the pleasures of life also. The fullness means all of it. And you can't open to one without opening to the other. It's a fundamental principle of Buddhism. You can't open only to the light, only to the joy and the pleasure of life. If you can open that fully, you have to at the same time be open to the sorrow and the suffering. If you can open fully to the sorrow and suffering of life, you can't do that without at the same time having a capacity to opening to the joy and the happiness. To open to both of them, to open fully to each of them is to allow the other as a possibility. To resist or to judge or to criticize one or the, or to emphasize or to select out one against the other, denies, and paradoxically will deny both of them, the fullness of both. So Buddhist practice leads to a kind of trust where we feel it's okay in some sense. And I use the word some sense as an important nuance to this, because we have to discover what this means. It doesn't necessarily mean happily ever after in a kind of naive way. But in some sense, it teaches us an ability to be trustable about what life comes to us. Or actually a better way of saying that, more realistic way of saying it, Buddhist practice teaches us not that life is trustable, that we can trust life, that we'll never get, you know, anything's going to happen to us, but rather what it can teach us is that our response to whatever life brings us can be trustable. And that's a very, very important distinction. I don't know if this follows exactly, but if you know the story of, I guess the myth or the fairy tale of the person who invented shoes, some king said, you know, there's all these pebbles and rocks and I'm cutting my feet as I walk across my kingdom. So he went to a leather maker or something and said, I want you to take leather and cover my kingdom with leather so I don't have to cut my feet anymore. And so the leather maker said, well, you know, there's an easier way. Rather than cutting out, making carpeting everything with leather, let's put leather underneath everybody's souls. And then you can walk with ease. So the same thing, I think, in meditation practice doesn't teach us how to control the whole world out there and make it all kind of perfect. It's never going to bother us again. But rather, meditation practice is like learning how to put shoes on our feet. And we learn that our response, our reaction to what goes on out there can be trustable. That we learn how to respond and react in a way. And trustable means that we ourselves, in our response to what happens to us in life, we don't add any suffering on top of what's already going on. That's the kind of trust that Buddhist practice tends to give. We ourselves don't add any suffering. So if you get fired from work and you're unemployed, that's bad. You know, it's bad enough. But to feel self-pity or feel fear on top of that or to feel embarrassed or the many kind of secondary reactions we have is to add a level of suffering on top of what's already an undesirable situation. What we learn from the practice is we learn a kind of trust in life, a trust in presence, a trust in resting in the fullness of being, where we can feel the difficulty of the situation, but we know that we ourselves is not going to add suffering on top of that. That kind of trust. Does that make sense to you? And the Buddhists believe that's a pretty radical thing, pretty phenomenal thing, because most of our suffering that really is anxiety-provoking and actually comes from ourselves, is how we respond. So meditation practice is just like, it's a very sensible thing because it's learning how to put on shoes. Most of us, many times we kind of want to carpet the whole world, you know, to make it a safe place for us, but that's unrealistic. But we can at least take care of how we meet. And the metaphor of shoes is a good one, because what happens then is we know we're taking care of the very place where we connect in the moment with life. You know, when the foot touches the ground. So meditation practice is not about blanketing, you know, the whole world to make it a safe place, but rather really understanding well the place of contact between ourselves and the world. And so there's a kind of soft cushion of awareness, of attention, that goes there in that meeting. And one of the things that means is we have to understand very well what it means to actually meet the world, what that place of contact is with the world itself. If we're lost in our thoughts, preoccupied in our thoughts and abstractions themselves are quite removed from the actual contact. So for example, if you go into your place of work and it's your first day of work in this new place and you don't know anybody, and you go in with some anxiety and you haven't even met anyone yet, but the last place you worked there was this terrible bully who was a boss, and there was this other person who was kind of manipulating everyone, and you're kind of worried that you're going to be taken advantage of again, and oh my God, if you know, and if they're going to notice that I'm not so smart about social skills, and maybe they don't realize, maybe they realize I don't type that fast, you know, I don't know how to kind of boot up the computer when it breaks down or whatever, and what if they see this and what if they say that, and what if the what if world is the world of abstractions. It has nothing to do with direct contact. And if we're going to use the souls, the kind of shoe of mindfulness, We have to understand where the point of contact is and learn to trust to live there much more. And what it means that is, what it means is when you go into that new, first day of work, what is the actual situation we find ourselves in as opposed to what we're afraid or anticipating or fantasizing the situation is like? What is actually going on? Who are the actual people there? What's the actual situation there? What's the actual things we're being asked to do? What is the actual as opposed to what is the fantasy? And many, many of us, I believe, live in fantasy, live in what ifs, what ifs. What if, what if, what if? Some of us, for example, are afraid of dying or afraid of someone else we know is going to die. It's painful to have death occur in our life, very painful. But what about all the what ifs that are maybe the cause of a lot of extra anxiety and suffering? The what ifs have to do with fantasy. What if my spouse dies? What if the spouse dies? Well, maybe then I can't support myself. But if I can't support myself, then what if I don't have the support? That means that I can't pay my mortgage, maybe. And what if I can't pay my mortgage? That means that I'm homeless. It's all this series of what ifs, which in some sense might be, you know, a little bit important to kind of anticipate, tiny bit. But to be lost in that world is to lose contact with what's really happening in the present moment. And it's a present moment that suffering and freedom from suffering can only occur. Fantasy and abstractions can cause anxiety at the worst, and it can cause relief at the best. But relief is not the same thing as really seeing, penetrating our suffering and being free of it. So we have to understand the point of contact of what's actually happening in the present moment. And if we do that, then we can learn to trust and to kind of rest back and allow that to come into us, that point of contact, to be receptive to it. And I think it's very instructive that the Buddhist word for faith, sadha in Pali, or shraddha, it's interesting, I'm sorry, footnote. I'm still in my graduate mode. The word shraddha in Sanskrit, which means faith, is a cognate, you know, Indo-European languages are connected to the word creed. The way the language pronunciations changed through the language tree, the CR of creed became was, you know, SR in Sanskrit, and the D is D, right? So creed and shraddha, these are connected words, but it's a very different sentiment. Creed means like a belief, but shraddha. So what I wanted to say is that the word earliest meaning of the Sanskrit word shraddha seems to have meant hospitality, to be hospitable. So part of what Buddhist faith or trust means is a willingness to be hospitable to our actual life. And the actual life is a life of real contact, where there's real contact between awareness and what's actually happening, not the abstractions. And a lot of meditation practice has to do with learning to rest in the direct contact of what's happening, rather than being lost in the abstractions. And that's what when we're spinning around in our thoughts, we're lost in abstractions. We're so interested in those thoughts. You know, that's why I started off this talk by talking about addiction. We're addicted to our thoughts. And many of us don't even know that we're lost in our thoughts. We don't know the possibility of resting someplace else. So one of the things it takes is that could be helpful is to be interested in something else besides our thoughts. And what are some of the things we can be interested in? One of the things you can be interested in as a meditator is in the process of meditation. What happens to you while you meditate? Are you being mindful? Are you being interested? Is there mindfulness? Is there attention? Are you in the present moment paying attention? Is there continuity of this attention over time? You know, I spend 2 seconds here and 2 minutes away. No continuity. Well, let's see. I'm interested in continuity. Continuity, let's explore. Let's try to develop more continuity. Let's try to sustain the attention over time. Is there engagement in the practice? Are we engaged? Are we inspired? Is there energy there to really make an effort? Are we making an effort? Or do we think that, you know, here I am, I'm sitting here, I've gotten here. It's a big deal to get here. I know it's difficult to come and meditate. I've arrived. That's good. Okay. I've done what I had to do. So much for that. You know, and off we go. We spend the next half an hour in fantasy. Simply sitting on the cushion is not enough. As Ajahn Sumedho said, if sitting on the cushion was enough, chickens would be enlightened. Are we engaged? Is there effort to pay attention in the present moment? Is there effort? So these things, effort, continuity or concentration, are factors of mind that come into play in meditation practice, which can be a subject of interest. Now, it's tricky. You don't want to make a subject of interest so you can judge yourself or so you can criticize yourself for how you're doing. But rather, you can do it very gently and lovingly as a way of not of relating to something different than your thoughts. To be interested in something else besides what's for dinner tonight. Oh, there's something going on here. And part of that exploration is not a thoughtful exploration, but happens in the intuitive kind of seeing of the mind's eye. Is there engagement here? Is there energy here? Is there continuity of effort here? Is there, you know, what's happening here in my practice? Is there faith? Is there trust? Is there receptivity here into my experience? These factors are considered to be are classic Buddhist factors that come into play when we meditate. And Buddhist teachers, meditation teachers, will study these factors, will listen to those factors when they listen to the experience of their students. So in more kind of to list them, because the first is trust or faith. The second is engagement or effort in the practice, making some effort. The third is mindfulness, being mindful, which is basic practice. The fourth is continuity or concentration, continuity of the practice over time, or concentration, being concentrated in doing the mindfulness. And the fifth is wisdom. And these five are supposed to be balanced with each other. Not each other, but faith and wisdom are considered to be pairs that get balanced. And faith, without wisdom, is considered often to be foolish, blind faith. And often it tends to be just kind of emotional then, kind of emotional faith. But wisdom without faith can be kind of dry and aloof and maybe just intellectual. But to combine the intellectual and the emotional is a function of the balancing these two. So we want to have some ability to have faith, some faith in the practice and faith in our ability to do the practice, some trust in allowing ourselves to experience contact with what's actually happening for us in our life. Are we trustable? Are we willing to allow whatever's coming to come? Then the second two are paired, and that is energy or effort and concentration or continuity. And these actually become very interesting, in the pair of these. The balance between effort and calm, effort and concentration. Calm and concentration are often considered synonymous. To have the balance between those two is a very important aspect of meditation practice. If we have too much energy when we come to sit, if we try too hard, we're too agitated, we just get more agitated, we feel anxious, the mind spins more and more, we get tired. If we have too little energy, then we're kind of slothful. There's not enough engagement, we're kind of complacent, we kind of drift off into thoughts. If there's not enough concentration, not enough calm or settledness, then again, it's all too easy to our mind to spin off with our preoccupations. If there's too much calm or too much concentration, too much stability, then that tends to create sleepiness. It kind of makes us kind of dull if we're too calm. A trick in meditation practice is to have these two factors balanced, to have effort or engagement balanced with continuity or concentration. So one of the things we can do in meditation practice is to be interested in the balance between these two things. Am I engaged with this practice? Am I interested? Am I inspired? Am I really doing it? I mean, just simply, are you doing it is a big question. Or are you just lost in your abstractions? But are you interested in being mindful? Are you engaged? Is there kind of alertness? What's going on here? Kind of subtle alertness. Or is it too much alertness? Are we trying too hard? Are we kind of like, a cat waiting for a mouse at the hole, just kind of anxiously tense, just ready to pounce? It's just, it's kind of, we're kind of resting, but not complacent, but also not anxious. And then there can be a balance. And then is it balanced with a proper amount of calm? Or is energy balanced with calm or concentration or continuity over time? So sometimes we can have good energy, but there's not much concentration. Sometimes we can have good concentration, but there's no real energy engagement. We're very focused, we're very calm, but there's no energy in the practice. So the trick is to have these two balanced. So we can be interested in these two things, in concentration, continuity of practice, and energy. Sometimes we can bring more energy, more effort in the practice, kind of wake up our effort, try a little bit more fully. Sometimes we need to back off and make a little bit less effort. Sometimes we need to make more effort to get concentrated, or a little more effort to get calm. Okay, so I'm a little bit too agitated here. Let me just stay quietly with the breathing, in a matter-of-fact, quiet way, and see if the breath can help calm me a little bit. Or develop some continuity through time, but in developing concentration. You can have very good energy and very good concentration, and the two are balanced. So the idea is not to have one stronger than the other. And you don't necessarily lower one, you have to raise the other to come to the same level. So, to take interest in something else besides our thoughts. We take interest in our body, what's our bodily experiences. To drop down into our physicality, what's going on in our body. The body experience is always in contact with what's happening in the present moment. That bodily experience is the contact, for the most part. So take interest in that. It can be a tremendous relief to the overzealous mind that's preoccupied with the thoughts all the time. Well, so much for my impromptu little talk. Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions you'd like to ask? Yes? Continuity is to maintain the attentiveness in the present moment through time. So say you're paying attention to the breath. You maintain it. You maintain subtly, quietly, gently attention to the breath through time so that you're not slipping off into your thoughts. So that you're there for the beginning and the ending of the in-breath, the full in-breath. You're there for the full out-breath. And after a while, we learn how to do it there. You learn what it tastes like, in a sense, to stay attentive through time, to keep the attention alert. It's like turning on a lamp, a light, and the light stays on. As soon as you get lost in your thoughts, the light's gone off. So we want to try to keep the light on as long as we can. Yes?
Could you talk a little bit more about trusting what's happening in your life? Is that what you were saying?
No, actually, I tried to make a distinction between that. I said that at first, but then I tried to back off from that. I tried to get away from that. But what we can trust is that place of contact and how we respond and react to it. That we don't have to add any extra suffering to that. That's what we can trust from the practice and from Buddhism. And that makes a big difference. But it's no guarantee that we're not going to break our leg or, you know, have a bad back or get fired. But it's going to make getting fired a lot more pleasant. Not super pleasant, but a lot easier. Does that make sense? And that sense of trust is so strong that I sometimes will kind of almost, you know, as a metaphysical kind of statement, religious statement, kind of say, well, life is trustable. Like, you can just trust life. But that's kind of, you know, that's kind of religious statement. I think what's much more realistic is you can really, what we learn in the practice is we can trust our responses if we're mindful in the present moment. One more question. Yeah?
Yeah, with regards to the continuity that you've been talking about, I'm fairly new with this and I'm having trouble with that. I sit and I try to pay attention to the breath and almost invariably something comes up. And one of the things I've noticed is that oftentimes a song will come into my mind, a song that I've heard recently or maybe an old favorite. And it'll start intruding on my ability to pay attention to my breath. So at first I just tried to, when that happened, I tried to put the song out of my mind and just come back to the breath. And after doing that for a few hundred times, I realized that it wasn't really changing. So I thought, well, perhaps I should pay attention to the song to see what happens when I do that. And when I do that, then as soon as I start paying attention to the song, it becomes less interesting. And it starts to fade away. And so then either I have a choice. I can either try to go back to the breath, in which case the same thing happens.
Yeah.
Or I can try to really make the song keep happening, but then that's really difficult, and then I start paying attention to how difficult it is.
Because it's difficult because it fades away.
Yeah, it fades away, right.
That often happens, things fade away. The point is to keep the light on. It doesn't matter what the flashlight is pointed at. So you're paying attention to your breath, and when you notice it's difficult to stay pay attention to the breath because of the song, then simply turn the flashlight to the song. And if the song vanishes, then just keep the light on and come back to the breath. But don't have some strong opinion that one is better than the other. Your job is a surf, kind of between them. And you know, you're not in charge.
I've noticed that.
Except, it's very important. You're not in charge, but except you're only what you're trying to be in charge of is the flashlight. You're trying to keep the light on. That's your task as a meditator. Beyond that, who knows what's going to happen? And you're supposed to, whatever happens, you try to bring the light of awareness to that, rather than the light of, you know, rather than getting lost in it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so if it happens 100 times or 1,000,000 times, you go back and forth with a breath and a song and a breath and a song, then you're doing the practice just fine. Because you're staying in the present moment, you keep keeping that light on, and what you'll learn is how to do that with ease, with graceful, back and forth. And what you'll find with time is that probably the song starts fading away, it doesn't come back with time, if you do it that way. The other thing you can do, which is some advice sometimes given around songs, which often happen to people, especially when they're more beginners in meditation, is if it's possible to ignore it, that's one advice that's given on songs. The other is to up the energy, up the effort a little bit more with the breath, to make more stringent effort to stay with the breath and not to leave it. Sometimes it's helpful, but that sometimes can make you kind of tense. So, enough? I wanted to welcome our new baby. Genevieve, you want to come up here? 4 weeks, maybe? How old is this? This is Liam.
And he'll be maybe till tomorrow.
I can't believe they're so small.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, they look small.
Ours at home is already 10 weeks old. Yeah. And he's a lot bigger. I don't remember him being that small anymore. They grew up fast.
They do.
Hi, sweetie.
And he's very alert tonight. I think he's picking up on something in this room. I had great expectations he would sleep. That's not happening. So he's very, very tuned in.
Well, he's been here before in this group.
Yeah.
He spent the last 9 months here. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Should we do a little blessing for Liam? I'd like to propose we do a little blessing for the baby. And so some of you might know this, and many of you maybe don't. I'm going to teach you a little Buddhist chant, a Pali chant. And if you don't like religious chanting, you don't have to think of it as religious chanting. Just change the way you think about it. And maybe this will substitute for your tune, if you like it. And all it is the Pali words, for may all beings be happy. And so the Pali words is sabbe means all, and satta means beings, and sukhi means happiness, and hontu means something like may they be. So may all beings be happy. Sabbe, satta, sukhi, hontu. So I'll chant one word at a time, you can repeat, and when I feel you've gotten it after a few rounds, I'll do the whole line, and then you can follow me with the whole line. And once I feel like you've gotten it, then we'll do it all together. And then in between each line, I'll start by offering a blessing or a wish to Liam. And then after I've done it a few times, then we'll open the floor, and anybody who wants to say something to this new baby Buddha can say something, and we all follow with the Pali, and the next person can say something. Does that make sense? So I'll repeat word by word. Sabbe. Sata.
Sata.
Sukhi. sabbe,
sabbe,
sata,
sata,
suki,
suki,
hontu,
hontu,
sabbe, sata, suki, hontu. Together. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. Liam, may you be filled with happiness. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. May you be filled with confidence. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. May you experience the love of your parents. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu.
May you be filled with kindness.
Sabbe sata sukhi hontu.
May you be healthy.
Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu.
May you love art.
Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. And may the mother be happy. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. And may all parents get lots of rest. Sabbe sata sukhi hontu. So, Liam, may that Buddha nature little seed in there, the seed of goodness and happiness and friendliness and trust, may that seed really sprout for you so it becomes a flower and a fruit that other people can enjoy also. May you be happy. Thank you all.